Have you noticed that politicians struggle to enact the things they run on? That regardless of who wins elections, lawmakers cannot pass whatever legislation they like. They find themselves bound by what is popular, or at least their sense of it. They can only act within a narrow set of ideas, and that range is called the Overton Window. And on the Overton Window, we look at issues around the country and talk to the people who change what is politically possible. College campuses used to be run with little regard for the free speech rights of students. And then something changed, or is changing. And so I'm talking to one of the people behind it. Ryan Weiss is the Director of Research for the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression, a free speech think tank and litigation center. Ryan, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
How are colleges not respecting free speech rights?
Well, that's a really interesting question because so I've been at FIRE for almost a decade. And in the time that I've been here, things have changed quite a bit on campus. When I started at FIRE back in 2016, there were a couple distinctive threats to free speech. The main one was overzealous administrators policing the speech of students for speech that might be, you know, considered offensive. Students started reporting on other students for offensive speech on social media. And that was kind of the status quo for how threats to free speech on campus were happening for a couple years.
You have free speech as long as it's not offensive and we determine what's offensive.
Exactly. Then you started having state legislatures passing restrictive bills like in Florida, the Stop Woke Act, that started trying to determine what professors could say in their classrooms about certain hot button issues relating to race and sex and you know, certain interpretations of history. This was kind of the beginning of a war on diversity, equity, and inclusion education. And, you know, FIRE actually has been critical of certain aspects of diversity, equity, and inclusion policies, especially the ones that would restrict free speech. Or, for example, at a lot of universities, professors who were being hired or professors who were seeking promotion would have to fill out a diversity, equity, and inclusion statement that would ask things about, you know, how are you incorporating diversity, equity, and inclusion ideology into your teaching? We consider these to be political litmus tests. They're asking, or they're pretty much telling professors that they need to incorporate this specific ideology into their teaching if they want to be hired or if they want to be promoted. And everyone kind of knows what the what they're looking for in those statements. So, you know, that was an overreach that threatened the rights of faculty on campuses. There's a severe backlash to that also went too far and started restricting what universities could teach through these restrictive laws by state legislatures. Then you saw in the summer of 2020, after the murder of George Floyd, that these the previous wave of you might call them cancellations, but attempts to get students and professors sanctioned for offensive speech kind of got turbocharged. And in just that summer, just a 3-month period, FIRE had more cases on campus in those 3 months than any previous 1-year period. And, you know, we were wondering, is this just going to become a new normal or is it going to settle down somewhat? The truth ended up being kind of in the middle of that. The amount of cases lowered from that summer, but it settled at a new normal that was way above what we had previously seen. And that was typically offensive speech that was touching on issues of race that people were trying to get their professors or classmates punished for. But then starting in October, after October 7th, a couple years ago when the attack on Israel happened, there was a seismic shift, and all of the controversies around racially offensive speech kind of faded into the background, and all of the stuff that we saw being challenged was speech on the Israel-Palestine issue. And this actually was the first time that the threats on free speech really changed to being overwhelmingly targeting speech that was on the left side of the political spectrum. Up to that point, with the exception of these state legislature attacks on DEI, the majority of the speech that was being targeted was speech that was coded as conservative. But post October 7th, when the speech that was targeting was overwhelmingly speech that was pro-Palestinian or had sympathies for Palestine, or on the extreme end had sympathies for Hamas and attacks on Israel, that became the largest source of attacks on free speech. So that then has led to these relatively dramatic incursions on the free speech rights of the universities themselves, who, as I mentioned, for the last decade have, you know, not covered themselves in glory as far as protecting free speech. They've made themselves kind of very unsympathetic targets. But, you know, these incursions from the Trump administration on the university's rights are themselves a violation of free speech principles. So
it's a target-rich environment for free speech violations.
Absolutely. Yeah. And the situation is just constantly changing, which on the plus side means that the work never gets boring. Things are always changing. It's very dynamic. But on the downside, you know, if you're really invested in these issues like we at FIRE are, it just, you know, becomes demoralizing to see the victims of attacks on free speech become the attackers and vice versa.
So, all right, let me summarize here. You're working on the ways that colleges are not respecting, or ways that their free speech is not being respected on campus. Offensive speech from both the right and the left is being punished by administrators. You've got states trying to say what professors can and can't teach. You've got let's see, some more activities that are being regulated on campus, both that are protests and things that can and cannot happen based on whether they're offensive. Is anyone making good moves to protect free speech rights on campus?
So that's a very good question. To kind of plug and give some credit to my alma mater, the University of Chicago, back in 2015, they released this pretty influential statement on free speech rights at universities called the Chicago Statement. A lot of universities then went on to adopt either the Chicago Statement or a very slightly edited version of that. And the University of Chicago, when I was there, was, you know, both good at protecting speech and also good at the more soft free speech thing of encouraging disagreement and dialogue across lines of difference.
This is an essential part of colleges, right? Like, these are supposed to be havens for free expression, of protecting academic liberties, to dig into controversial issues and to talk about them in a nurturing environment where you're open to discussion, debate on controversy.
Absolutely. And this is the reason why FIRE was founded. We started as an organization called the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, and we're focused entirely on campus free speech issues. A couple years ago, we expanded to being the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression, increasing our ambit from just free speech on college campuses to free speech in the nation at large. And that was due to kind of overwhelming demand for us to take this work that we had been doing on campus and bringing it off. But, you know, as I was just talking about all the threats to free speech, the biggest ones tend to be on campus. Campuses have been created in the United States as this special place where free speech is especially protected. You have this concept of academic freedom that kind of embodies this special environment for free speech that happens on college campuses, where even the Supreme Court has recognized, you know, academic freedom is a special interest of the First Amendment. And that's because when college students are, you know, developing their beliefs, they're being educated, they're learning about all these issues, it's really important for them to have the right to speak candidly, to, you know, play with different ideas, and even in a lot of cases to be wrong and not face consequences for being wrong. Because a great part of the growth that comes intellectually comes from being an error, having that error, you know, corrected through argument, not through punishment. And for faculty, they're the ones on the cutting edge of science, research, philosophy. That involves exposing things that society might think is wrong or wrongheaded. But if they don't have the right to push the boundaries with arguments, that means that whatever we currently believe to be true just gets kind of calcified, and you can't go beyond that. And, you know, many of the things that we as a society have thought to be true are wrong. Even things that we thought were scientifically supported, it turns out that some of that science was, you know, either deeply flawed, or even in some cases, you know, fraudulently created. So it's really important that students and faculty have this wide latitude to approach issues without sanction, or without, you know, anyone deciding these are the bounds of discourse, these are the bounds of reality, and if you step outside of this, you will be punished. That's exactly what our systems of universities were designed to avoid. And unfortunately, we see in a lot of cases, people really want to place those strictures on debate.
Ryan, what are you doing to protect campus free speech rights?
So my department is the research department at FIRE. And so our ambit is to create research that helps us better understand the situation for free speech on campus, because it's very hard to solve a problem if you don't have accurate, actionable data on that problem. So we've created this thing called the College Free Speech Rankings, which over time have gotten
a lot more. Everybody loves college rankings.
Everybody loves college rankings. And our hope with creating these rankings were to, you know, really pin down what are some actionable areas where colleges can improve their environments for free speech. And, you know, also provide them an incentive to improve, because no one wants to be at the bottom of free speech rankings. And colleges are who wind up at the top, they can, you know, advertise that they have a relatively good environment for free speech, and so they might fight to stay there. We wanted to create an incentive structure for universities to be good on free speech. And so the various aspects that we include in our rankings, one of the big ones, and this is the one that FIRE has been tracking for the longest, is what are the free speech policies at those universities? We grade universities on a red, yellow, green light rating system. A green light university is one that has no policies that substantially restrict free speech. A yellow light policy is one that has vague, it's a policy that is vague enough that it could be interpreted to restrict free speech. And then a red light policy is one that clearly and substantially restricts free speech. FIRE's been tracking university policies for a really long time. We track policies at I believe, around 450 universities. Whereas our college free speech rankings, those incorporate more information, but those only cover about 250 universities. So, you know, we had heard over the years there's a distance between policy and action, and some universities with great speech policies actually have a really bad environment for free speech. So we created the free speech rankings to give a more holistic and nuanced view of free speech on campus. So it incorporates more information. And the big thing that we added first was a survey of the students at that university. Now, the survey that we do every year is the largest survey of student attitudes on free speech. And so we're asking students things like, how free do you feel to speak on campus? How often do you self-censor? How confident are you that your university administration would protect your free speech rights? And we also ask them things about their specific views on free speech, like what speakers do they think should be allowed on campus? What kinds of illiberal attitudes do they think are appropriate to respond to offensive speech with? So things like, you know, shout downs or even on the extreme end, violence in response to offensive speech. The last thing that we incorporate are what we call kind of the behavioral metrics. So this is kind of the where rubber meets the road. What is the university actually doing when it comes to speech controversies? So we track in our deplatforming database actual attempts to get speakers deplatformed, things like shout downs, and not just speakers. It also includes things like art exhibits, film screenings, and things like that. We have our Scholars Under Fire database, which is tracking attempts to get scholars sanctioned.
Right, I gotta say, I love the puns that you guys keep using.
Yeah. People ask us about the puns a lot. And as one kind of funny thing, I'm sure you've heard of the fire in a crowded theater concept of free speech. We actually don't know whether.
Right.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. It's a myth. People often say you can't yell fire in a crowded theater, and the actual situation is a lot more complicated than that. In a lot of cases, yelling fire in a crowded theater could be protected, especially if, you know, for example, there is a fire in that theater. But anyway, the people frequently will ask us, is fire a pun on the fire in a crowded theater concept? And no one actually remembers whether or not that was the case. So it very may well be that our name is a pun on that, but no one remembers at this point. not even our founders. So
anyway, back to Scholars Under Fire.
Back to Scholars Under Fire. So it tracks instances of trying to sanction scholars, which could be graduate students or faculty, for their protected speech. And so in those instances, we'll penalize the university. Similarly, Students Under Fire attempts to sanction students or student groups for their speech. So the if you want to think about the rankings as, you know, three big buckets, there is the bucket of what are the school's policies. There's the bucket of how free do the students feel to express themselves, and you know, what illiberal actions do they think are appropriate in response to offensive speech? And then there's what do the universities actually do when they're facing calls for sanction or censorship? Are they actually punishing the scholar or the student that people want punished? Are they allowing a shout down or violence to happen in response to offensive speech? So we take all these different factors and we weight them. We have a public methodology, and all of the instances that we are tracking in these Students and Scholars Under Fire databases and the deplatforming databases, all of those things are public. So if anyone wants to check our work, we make all of that data available to them. If someone, you know, thinks that this is all useful information, but they want to, you know, weight things in a different way because maybe they think that the student attitudes are a lot more important than the policies, et cetera, they're welcome to use the information that we make public to make their own rankings about universities. But the response to this ranking system has actually been really great and kind of beyond our expectations. University administrations have reached out to us asking, you know, how can we do better on your rankings? A lot of times they're coming to us because their alumni and their donors look at our rankings and they see, you know, I truly believe in the atmosphere at this, the atmosphere in this school, and I want you guys to improve on these rankings. And so we have our policy reform team, who are the same people who do the red, yellow, and green light ratings, work with administrators at these schools to improve the policies. That's the biggest thing that universities fall short on, and the easiest way to improve. The question of how do you make your students feel more comfortable expressing themselves on campus, that is the much harder nut to crack, and the one that you know, takes a lot more work. As far as how a university might do that, their public statements mean a lot. The emails that they send to their student body can really create the impressions that those universities or those students have about whether or not their speech rights are protected on campus. But by the same token, a university's public actions in response to these speech controversies can have a massive chilling effect. At a school where the university is...
I want to dig in on a little bit something you mentioned, which is you've got some pressures that are encouraging more respect for free speech rights. Our donors, or just people who are replying. Why is there so much illiberalism about free speech on campus in the first place? What's driving that?
That is a, you know, that's kind of the million-dollar question.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I'll have to check.
I take kind of a view that people do not naturally want to defend the speech rights of people who have views that they find offensive or dangerous. There is this saying that I believe it's from Nat Pentoff, but I'm sure one of my colleagues will correct me if I'm wrong there, that the strongest human urge is to censor one's opponents, and the urge for sex is a distant second. The
bold claim.
Yeah, it's a pretty bold claim, but I think it goes to show that, you know, when we see speech that we really don't like and that we're afraid it's going to persuade other people, if you don't have a lot of education on the importance of free speech, your first urge might be to censor that speech. And it takes, you know, a lot of understanding of either the principles underlying why it's important to have freedom of expression in a democratic society, or, you know, a knowledge of how punishments for speech will inevitably be weaponized in both directions. The precedents that you set that one group can be targeted for their speech, as soon as power shifts hands, it will be used to attack the other side. And, you know, I think we have our Students Under Fire database, which is launching tomorrow. Based on this recording, when people hear this, it will already be out. It has these graphs showing where student speech has been targeted on the political spectrum. So it tracks whether or not the pressure to censor speech is coming from the left or the right of the speaker. And the graph has a crossover point, basically at the October 7th attack, where the majority of the attacks were targeting speech from the left of that speech. And after October 7th, the majority of attacks have been coming from the right. We've, you know, the presidential administration talked about censorship on the left, and then you know, they have a point in a lot of cases as far as the Biden administration jawboning social media companies trying to get speech that was either offensive or against the administration's policies on COVID removed from social media platforms. And now that same, you know, and now the administration, which had decried these as attacks on free speech, is jawboning universities, trying to get them to implement restrictive policies as far as protest and speech on Israel-Palestine. And, you know, in a lot of cases, they're pointing out protests that went far beyond protected speech, protests that involved, you know, vandalism, building occupations, things that the universities are well within their rights to punish. And, you know, they claim would have punished for speech that had a different viewpoint. And, you know, maybe they're right there, but that doesn't mean that the administration can force these universities to impose restrictive speech codes that go far beyond the policing of unprotected speech. I think that the problem is that it takes a lot of education and a lot of introspection to really understand the value of free speech. And it's very easy to fall into this trap of, well, those guys don't respect free speech, so I'm not going to respect it either, or I'm going to, you know, take revenge on the other guys for their censorship. And so you get into this cycle where, you know, an attack is met with a counterattack, and suddenly everyone's free speech rights are in doubt, and there is no clear off-ramp for these escalating attacks on free speech.
Yes, it reminds me of a point. When you're tempted to fight fire with fire, remember that the fire department usually uses water.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but that's a great line.
But so you've got this the seesawing between oppressing free speech on the right and oppressing free speech on the left, and you want to come up with a compromise where we all learn a valuable lesson that it's just better to respect free speech rights. What are you doing to kind of land to convince people that that's the case? Like, or sorry, you've already mentioned some of the stuff that you're doing. Is it working?
Well, I will say that among my liberal friends who had been skeptical of FIRE up to this point, they've seen all of the work that we've done defending pro-Palestinian protesters who are being targeted for their free expression. You have Rumestia Ozturk, who was, you know, imprisoned and threatened with deportation for writing an op-ed, and the administration, when offered every opportunity to point out anything that she did beyond writing that op-ed, they didn't present anything, and they didn't even cross-examine her. You know, my liberal friends see that. They see FIRE being at the forefront of fighting for that. And, you know, while they had believed that we were a conservative organization before that, they're seeing us being consistent on that, and that's starting to change their opinion on free speech. However, on the other side, you see conservatives who had really been cheerleaders for FIRE when FIRE was primarily defending conservatives whose rights were being attacked on campus, you know, accusing us of having, you know, succumbed to liberal bias or something like that. So, you know, people are going to interpret FIRE's actions through their partisan lens, and they're going to be inclined to see us as fair brokers when we're defending speech that they like, and they're going to be inclined to see us as biased when we're defending speech that they don't like. However, that's the glass half empty kind of way of looking at it. And there's a glass half full kind of way of thinking about it, which is that people forget about how important their free speech rights until they're under attack. The current moment, having just had a lot of free speech attacks on conservative speech being followed very shortly by attacks on liberal speech, just the sort of closeness in time between those two things might provide more obvious evidence for the importance of neutral defense of free speech. So I do think that this is an opportunity to create more of the kind of principled defenders of free speech who are willing to defend free speech, not when their own side's ox is getting gored, but on the other side's ox getting gored, knowing that, you know, whatever precedents get set where you can, you know, restrict this free speech, it'll be turned around and weaponized against them when power shifts, and power always shifts.
So you've got the primal forces that encourage illiberalism on campus, and you're trying to encourage more civilized forces to take a longer view. You're trying to encourage colleges to take these ideas seriously, and you're trying to measure something that is difficult to measure and telling them that they should care about it. These are opposing mm-hmm. forces. Are you mm-hmm. winning or are you losing?
I think that we are making great headway on improving policies on college campuses. I think universities are now recognizing what these stakes might be for being seen as hypocrites on freedom of expression. You saw the presidents of Harvard and University of Pennsylvania being brought before Congress and questioned on their what they were doing to respond to anti-Semitism on campus. And those presidents were making the arguments in terms of free speech. And the things that they were saying were, you know, literally correct, but they were getting absolutely eviscerated because their records just didn't show them standing behind offensive speech in the past. And so, you know, they weren't persuading anyone because they had this extremely long paper trail of censorship. And I think the better answer from them would have been like, yes, we've fallen short in the past, but we are going to take these concrete actions to improve the situation for free speech on campus. I think that it's now very clear that the public will not accept a university employing this clear double standard on what speech is allowed and what speech is protected. And I think that universities going forward will improve on free speech just as a matter of survival. And we've, you know, been making a lot of headway at a lot of universities that have been continual bad actors on campus. I won't, you know, name and shame people who are now coming to the table and wanting to improve, but, you know, there are some schools that we had, I don't want to say written off, but that we had a very dim, pessimistic view on that administration taking free speech rights seriously. And they're coming to the table now, and they seem to be sincere, and they're enacting some really real reforms. So we've seen a lot of...
That's got to feel pretty good to have bad actors come to you and say, what can we do to fix things?
It does. And that is really great. But unfortunately, now we have kind of unprecedented attacks coming from the executive that are, you know, making this progress a lot harder to carry forward. Like, for example, if the schools who have been threatened with the pulling of hundreds of millions of dollars of funding accede to all the demands of the presidential administration, they would be putting on the books restrictive speech policies that FIRE would, you know, have to rate those universities down for. It kind of undoes whatever reform efforts that we had been trying. So, what we're seeing, I guess, is that a group who had been not great on free speech are maybe coming into the light, and then you have another group that is attacking free speech who previously championed it. So it's hard to say on net that the situation is better now than it was, you know, a year ago, but we're seeing some positive things in some places that we had previously not seen a lot of positive things. So, you know, the work is never done.
So I think that respecting free speech rights on campus ought to be something that is within the Overton window. as in it should be politically feasible to just let or to respect people's free speech rights that already exist, that are already part of the state or are already part of the U.S. Constitution. They have these rights, and it ought to be politically feasible and policy that your ability to speak on campus is respected. What are so I think that's politically feasible right now, even though there are pressures for liberalism that if kind of control these policies. What would help you secure free speech rights?
The biggest thing, it's so easy to defend free speech rights of a speaker that you agree with or for speech that you agree with, that it's, you know, basically automatic. Everyone is inclined to do it. People are willing to take more risks when it comes to defending free speech of people they agree with. But the thing that's really important and the thing that's a lot more difficult is defending free speech rights when it is a speaker that you don't like, when it's speech that is antithetical to your personal values. But when you do that, people take notice. They see it as, you know, what the courts say, an admission against interest. If they see you defending free speech of speech that you disagree with, it just means a lot more. And it makes people stop and think about it. It's really important right now that people take a strong stand when they see the speech rights of people that they disagree with being violated, and to, I guess, proselytize might be the right word, to their side on why it's important to defend that speech, even if they don't agree with it. I would take, you know, 10 people defending speech that they disagree with over 1,000 people defending speech that they agree with. That's where you can make a real impact. And if you can convince the people on your side to defend the speech of the other side, that is meaningful in a way that the standard tribalism tit for tat isn't.
Ryan, good luck on your attempts to shift the Overton window.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Overton Window, a podcast from the Mackinac Center. Please subscribe and rate. For more, check us out at www.mackinac.org. That's Mackinac with a C, like the island.